Session number 28933, Cyril Pierce, part 6.
The wind speed was important, not only for you to make an accurate flight, but it also had to be put into the bomb site, because the terminal velocity of the bombs, of course, depending on the size, the wind could have an effect on them as they dropped. And the higher you were, the further they had to drop, therefore there would be more effect from the wind to make the bombs go astray. So that was a very essential thing that was needed. Once you had, we were expected to find our own targets. There was no pathfinder force. But what we were told to do, we had to drop one flare to see that we got the target, and if we had, we then came round and did our bombing run. But the beauty of flying in the Mediterranean was the visibility was absolutely wonderful. And finding targets was easy. Now, unlike in Germany, where you flew hundreds of miles overland, and if you got the wind speed right and other things right, you'd find your target if you could see it. Italy is such a long, narrow piece of land that it was very easy, and so you couldn't overshoot it because you could see the sea, and it was very simple to find your targets because you could map read in the very good visibility. And the whole of my 38 trips, I'm still counting, of course, number one, the flight out from England, I found my target every time. You had to do 250 hours of flying, actual combat flying, to count as a tour. And it took me 38 trips to do that. Once you'd bombed, then of course, found your target and you bombed it. And then of course you got away as fast as you could coming back home. And one of the things I always did, it could become, it was stressful, but it could become tiring. And whenever I was coming home, although I never bombed from more than 8,500 feet, as I've got in my logbook here. On my second tour I bombed from higher than that, but on my first tour, I never bombed, as we could pick our own height, I never bombed from more than 8,500 feet. And in most on most occasions it was from 7,000 feet. So you could have you could see the target clearer. In fact, our station commander, Group Captain Speedy Powell, when he was giving the briefings, he always said, "Go in low." And when he said low, he meant about 3,000 feet. But nobody took any notice of him. On that, as you could go at what height you wanted. And some of the squadrons used to go very high. So you'd see flak bursting at 12,000 feet and you were below it. The navigator would give you the course to fly home. And of course you flew and got back to your own airfield. Each of the three airfields had their own identification signal, which was simply one letter of the Morse code, and then you would land and go to debriefing. And we weren't given, as I've read and heard about so often, that in Bomber Command in England, before the crew took off, they were given a tot of rum. Well, I can assure you they weren't given anything like that in the desert. I can remember coming back and we were having, and the meal they would present us with would be bully beef stew and a hard biscuit. As I say, if you wanted eggs, you had to buy them yourself from the Arabs. It did get better towards the end. So after you had debriefed, of course, then you went to bed.
And what was the, did the debriefing tell
you? Well, you had to tell exactly, detail the height you'd bombed, the direction, if, and of course, some of the aircraft out in the desert had cameras, not all, because Bomber Harris made sure England came first, and he made sure all his aircraft had cameras. So, that was one of the points, of course. On your bombing run, your bomber would give you directions. You could see the target in front of you, and you would fly towards it, and you'd be given instructions, right. You wanted to go a little bit to the right, left, steady, and bomb's gone. But then you had to wait for 15 seconds on a straight and level path for your photo flash to go off so you could have a photograph taken of by the photo flash. Later on in England, you weren't awarded an operation unless you produced a photo flash back home, because there were one or two crews who'd been deliberately going away from the target and dropping their bombs anywhere. On my second tour, we did have cameras, but we still, as far as I know, that didn't apply. If you did an op, you did an op. Then they, you would explain what you saw of the target, what the flak was like, if you were, and in the desert, they were all tactical targets. They were all airfields, docks, marshalling yards. We never bombed an ordinary city open bombing. It was always a target. And of course, he'd want to know what you saw there. And it was the mainly the rest of the crew would tell him, particularly the air gunner, because you were flying the plane, and you were making sure, of course, over the target, that it was straight and level, because if it wasn't straight and level, when you dropped the bombs, they'd go askew. And also, you had to keep it straight and level, of course, for the photo flash, for the camera to operate with the photo flash. And they would then wonder, did you see any other aircraft shot down, or any searchlights, or any others being shot down, what the flak was like, what the searchlights were like. As much information as they could at the actual debriefing. And then, as I said, you went to bed. So, to try and fool the Germans, that we were going to invade Sardinia, not Sicily. As I said, I'd already told you about the bloke they've dropped in the sea. I had to do my fifth off was on Olbia in Sardinia, which was simply a port. And my seventh off was at Cagliari, also in Sardinia, which was another airfield. No, it wasn't. It was that side. We were. They had a very big military installation there. It was a barracks, and that was our target. And it was very close to the railway station. So, those were the two ops I did on Sardinia. Now we went in and invaded. Sicily, and it was the 4th or the 8th of July, I know. I forget one that it was on Syracuse. That was on the 9th of July. They were invading Sicily. So we were used as diversions. The six squadrons were at maximum strength. That would make, as I say, 120 aircraft. Two squadrons were sent to bomb the port of Syracuse. Two were sent to bomb the airfield at Catania. And that was, of course, all Germans there. The ITIs were useless. And the other two, I think, I can't remember what the other two were on, but we were told we had to do two runs on the port of Syracuse. We were over the target, and we hit the town and Nops. It was a good piece of bombing. In fact, I read somewhere in some book that up to that time it was the most accurate bombing of the war, but I can't find the book in which it was written. And then from then onwards, of course, we were attacking the places in Sicily. And we were going quite a lot to Catania, which was the German airfield. And the odd thing was that about 10 years ago, I belonged to the Aircrew Association, and we had somebody giving us talks. And we had a German pilot who gave us a talk. His name was Ernst Wedding, spelt with a W, Wedding, Wedding. And he had been at Catania when the Italian when we invaded Sicily, and he remembers that the night that we bombed Catania. I asked him the question. I said, "Well, you," he said, "he'd been at Catania. He calls it Catania." And I said, "Well, I bombed it twice." "Oh," he said, "did you? Thank you." And from then onwards, it was attacks on Sicily, and on one of the nothing very much. Yes, of course. Then I had this taxiing accident, and as I told you, the aircraft were scattered. What was the word I used? Dispersed, that's right, in case they had attacks from the Germans who were still in Sicily. And you had to taxi at night from your dispersal along a track which again had been lightly bulldozed, and this was practically always in sand, right away from the cultivated areas. And I was taxiing along with we were going to Naples, full bomb load, full petrol load, and you had to taxi just using the navigation lights. And what they had done, they had put markers, pieces of stone painted, whitewashed, to give you the track. And something had gone wrong, because I suddenly felt a bump, and I pushed the throttles forward further, and I found that the aircraft was being turned around. And what I'd done is I'd hit the tail with my starboard wing. I'd hit the tail, fin and rudder, of a Park Wimpy. I thought I was in a rut, and when I gave it more throttle, of course, that had meant my aircraft had turned, and it then had taken the fin and rudder off this Wimpy, and then had slewed round, and my starboard wing was resting on the port wing of that Wimpy. So obviously I was finished on that op. I had to get on the telecom and tell them that I'd had an accident. So they came and took us back to base, and I couldn't go. I had to see the wing commander the following day, and I told him what had happened. I had to make a written statement, and I told him what had happened, that this Wimpy, in my opinion, had been parked in the wrong way. If it had been better if the front of the Wimpy had been in near the path rather than the back, and I wouldn't have clobbered it. And he said to me, He was at Wing Commander Gibbs. He was a New Zealander, a damn nice bloke. And he said to me, he said, could you therefore see quite clearly your way to the airfield? And I said, well, on this occasion, I couldn't, sir. He said, therefore, he said, then you should have had somebody to have marshalled you out. And that, now that would have meant a bloke with two torches walking backwards for nearly a mile to get to the airfield, which he knew was a load of cobblers, but was laid down, of course, in RAF regulations. So I was to blame. And that, what happened after that, I wasn't on the battle order one night, but I was told to report to briefing. So after the briefing, before all the aircrew dispersed, Speedy Powell, who was our station commander, Group Captain Speedy Powell, a big toffee-nosed twit he was, he appeared, by the way, in that film Target for Tonight. I don't know whether you've seen that, have you? He said, Sergeant Pierce, come up onto the little dais they'd got. So I stood up. And he then pointed at me in front of all the aircrew and said, saboteur! He said, this idiot was responsible for £30,000 worth of damage because he was taxiing like a madman. And, of course, deadly silence. The rest of the aircrew there, and I think the other officers on squadron commander and flight commanders who were there, I think they were very upset by this because it should have been done privately. It was done in front of the whole of the aircrew. And then he said, right, dismiss. I received a lot of pats on the back and sympathy from other aircrew, but there it is in my logbook. On a double page, endorsements regarding avoidable flying accidents and established breaches of flying discipline not necessarily involving accident. Accident involving aircraft Wellington 10 HE720 on the 26th of June 1943, class of accident, taxiing, degree of blame, carelessness. Signed, Speedy Power, Group Captain Commanding Number 330 Wing, not 331. Now, I wasn't very keen on Speedy Power after that, because, but there it is, on a double page of my logbook is this red endorsement, and I'm very proud of it. Odd thing, Speedy Power went on to bow fighters. Now, they also had the Hercules 16 engines. And when I got to Italy on my second tour, he'd just been shot down and killed. I'm sorry if that happened to him, but that was Speedy Powell. So, I got over from that, haven't I? A lot of the targets, don't forget, by the time Sicily had been conquered, we were still, of course, attacking targets in Italy. And on the invasion of Salerno, that was on my log, the 22nd of August, 43. You might or might not know, but the opposition were more or less waiting for us, and it was a joint task force, American and British, and they took a hell of a pounding, and we had to go to Salerno and the nearby places at night to try and help out. We were. On one occasion, we had to bomb the German lines, which was only about half a mile away from the British lines, but we had to be so very careful that if we couldn't find the German lines, then we had to go and bomb something else, because we daren't drop bombs on our own troops. But we found the German lines, and without any trouble, and we bombed them.
Did you meet any opposition from...
I never met any night fighters.
No.
I was lucky there. In fact, I was lucky in lots of ways. I never met a German night fighter. We had the odd scare later on my second tour when they dropped fighter flares, but I was never attacked. My rear gunner, Ted, of course, was very, very good, and he could spot them a long way out and would say, right, there's a night fighter in there, turn to port, dive to port, and you do immediate dive to port, or the other way. So if he did that, of course, you'd be out of the way and they couldn't get you. So I was very fortunate in that, because the fighter opposition over Sicily and Italy, particularly, we didn't have much regard for the Italians at all, but the Germans were good. They were very good.
Did you know this manoeuvre called a corkscrew?
Yes. That came in, we were taught that at ITW. But the only time I ever used that was when Ted said, right, there's a fighter on the starboard quarter, and it looks as though he spotted us. So I then went into the corkscrew. Otherwise, you would weave and turn. But the corkscrew was it was fairly effective. But later on, when we were over in on my second tour, I need to come to that when I get there. But now I did have when we were attacking Naples, I was on my bombing run and ready to drop my flare to find the target, and the master searchlight, which was the blue one, suddenly flicked on straight onto me. Now, I knew you've got to get out of the way, and I was at 6,000 feet. No, that was Naples. It could have been Torre Annunziata. Well, it might have been later on. Anyway, I knew I had to get out of that straight away. So I simply did a great steep diving turn to starboard, because the searchlight had come on from the starboard and you dived into it. And a steep diving turn. Twisted and turned about. On one occasion, I almost stalled the engine, almost stalled the aircraft, but I got out of the searchlight. I got out of it. So then, of course, that meant I had to climb back up to my height and then come round and do my bombing run. But during the fierce manoeuvre, the Elsan, and you know, every bomber had an Elsan toilet, Jack was standing by the flare chute in order to drop the flare down, which was opposite the Elsan, and the straps on the Elsan either broke or hadn't been properly done up, and the Elsan went flying right across the aircraft and covered poor old Jack with its contents. Now, don't forget, they put the chemical in the Elsan, and then you did your business in it. And, of course, the ground crew, who were working on the aircraft in the heat of the day, if they wanted to go to the toilet, they weren't going to walk half a mile and come back, so they used the Elsan. They should empty them out, But they obviously hadn't on this occasion, because poor old Jack got the whole contents of this Elsan on him. And that was in my manoeuvres to get out of the searchlight. And so I still had to climb up, do my bombing run, and Jack still had to stay by the flare chute because he had to put the light, the... Photo flash in, that's right. He had to do that, put the photo flash in, and so we could take a picture. He stunk like hell, the whole aircraft did. When we got back to debriefing, when he walked into the tent, there was such a stink he was told to bugger off. And and after the briefing, we took him to the water bowser, and we took off his parachute and his May West, and we simply stuck him under the bowser, and we soaked him and all his uniform to get rid of all this muck. And I don't think the ground crew were very happy, but it must have been their fault, because either it hadn't been properly secured. It was the Elsan was secured by thick elastic bands going around it. It either hadn't been properly secured or the bands had broken. In the another occasion where we had a little bit of trouble, there had been a lot of... When you came back from an operation, there was a light in the bomb bay, and the bomb bay was sticking up in the fuselage, inside the fuselage, shaped rather like a coffin. And there was a little window in the back, and the bomb aimer simply switched the light on in the bomb bay, looked through this small window to see if any bombs were hung up. Now, on this occasion coming back, again it was from Naples, and he said, Skipper, he said, there's two hang-ups. One was a 500 pounder and the other was a 250 pounder. Now, we had been given strict instructions not to bring any hang-ups back. There had been, amongst the six Wimpy squadrons, there had been four explosions when the armourers were maintaining the aircraft. They had been warned there were hang-ups on them, but of course a hang-up, the fuse on a bomb could be instantaneous on explosion, or it could be timed up to a time of several days after the bomb dropping.